Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, I'm Tom Gilson, and today I'm pleased to bring you the first in a three-part series featuring Uncommon Knowledge host Peter Robinson interviewing Stephen Meyer, David Berlinski, and Yale mathematician David Galernter. Their conversation occurred in the hills above Florence, Italy, and it's presented here at ID the Future thanks to the generous permission of Robinson and the Hoover Institution.
Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson, shooting today in Fiesole, a town in the hills above Florence, Italy. With me today, three guests. David Berlinski is a philosopher, mathematician, and author who has lived in Paris for a couple of decades now and is now the editor of Inference, the International Review of Science. David Galernter is a professor of computer science at Yale and the author of a number of books, including most recently The Tides of Mind, Uncovering the Spectrum of Consciousness. Stephen Meyer is a philosopher and author. He directs the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute, a think tank in Seattle. Here's what brings us together. In the Claremont Review of Books this past spring, David Galernter published an essay titled Giving Up Darwin. Quote, Stephen Meyer's thoughtful and meticulous book, Darwin's Doubt, convinced me that Darwin has failed. The Deniable Darwin and Other Essays, a book by David Berlinski, is also, quote, essential. David Galernter, David Berlinski, Stephen Meyer, welcome.
Thank you.
All right, definitions. Darwin's book is on the origin of species, and to quote from David Galernter's essay, quote, there's no reason to doubt that Darwin successfully explained the small adjustments by which an organism adapts to local circumstances, changes to fur density, or wing style, or beak shape. Yet there are many reasons to doubt whether he can explain the big picture, not the fine-tuning of existing species, but the emergence of new ones, close quote. Okay, I'm a layman, I know nothing. Start by convincing me, somebody, that you're not just defining the term species to Darwin's disadvantage. Who wants to take that one? David?
There really is very little disagreement on the issue of what a species is, and I think it doesn't have to be a technical term. Mm-hmm. I think virtually any alert child knows when he passes from one species of pet creature to another species, or what
dog, cat.
Yeah, a cow or a sheep or something like that. This is part of our innate view of the universe. Nobody wants to define anything to Darwin's disadvantage. I think you're looking at three scientists here, and I think every one of us has appreciated, and I am speaking only for myself, but I'd be surprised, appreciated the beauty of what Darwin did. It certainly was no joy to conclude that Steve was right. It was no joy for me to give up a beautiful theory, and one
why
that
was it beautiful?
Was such a
why
good
was it beautiful? Beautiful is aesthetic, so there's something subjective about it. But explain that. Why did Darwin strike you as beautiful?
Each year of my life, I am less convinced that there is anything at all subjective about beauty.
Really?
The fact that here we are in Florence, and every single person in the city wants to see the Michelangelo self-portrait I mentioned to you, and the slaves in the Accademia, and the great paintings in the Uffizi. People come from all over Asia. People come from Africa. They come from all over the world. There's spectacularly little disagreement. I mean, there's disagreement about theorems and topology also. When people say, I believe the proof, I don't believe the proof. There's disagreement about everything in human life, but I think less about the greatest art than about any other subject. Beauty is something that I think scientists tend to agree on to use as a pointer in the direction of truth. Darwin's theory struck me as beautiful insofar as it explains big things by generalizing little things. You mentioned the change in the density of fur on a creature with fur, the shape of the beak of a bird or of a feather of a bird. Darwin can explain those things by principles of natural selection. And when he says, well, we can go from these little changes, a beak is 3 inches as opposed to 3 1/4 inches, we can use the same mechanism that by which we explain that to explain why there are sheep and cows, why there are monkeys and also orangutans, and why apes are different from monkeys. The fact that we can explain this huge question of where species came from, the origin of species, using the same mechanism that will work for tiny variations in the fur of a sheep or the beak of a bird is one aspect of what makes the theory beautiful. I mean, other people look at it and from different
just quickly, because I want to go into the arguments against, but did you have the same response? Does Darwin strike you as beautiful?
Never for a minute.
Stephen?
It was a comprehensive synthesis. And so from the standpoint of what scientists look for, it had an appeal. It was also a well-argued book, The Origin of Species. But it was well-argued on the basis of evidence that was known in the 19th century and not things that we've learned mostly from the 20th and 21st.
Okay, we come to that now. Again from David Galeranter's essay, quote, Darwinian, the fossil record, problem one, the fossil record, Darwinian evolution, I'm quoting you, is gradual, step by step. Yet in the Cambrian explosion of around 500 million years ago, a striking variety of new organisms, including the first ever animals, pop up suddenly in the fossil record over a mere 70 million years, close quote. Now, 70 million years seems to be plenty of time for all kinds of surprising things to this layman. Explain, why is the Cambrian explosion such a problem for
Darwin?
Well,
the Cambrian explosion was something that...
Such a problem that it even began to convince this man.
Yeah, you know, it was a problem that even Darwin was aware of, and he wrote about it in The Origin of Species. He said it was inexplicable on his view of life. But he felt that the future fossil finds would fill in the missing ancestral forms that were evident. What happens in the Cambrian is you get a huge number of what are called the animal body plans, where a body plan is a unique configuration of body parts and tissues. And they arrive very abruptly in the fossil record without discernible connection to earlier precursors or earlier ancestors in the Precambrian record.
So if this wall were the side of a canyon, halfway up we'd see...
You have a stripe of rock, and in that stripe you'd find a whole bunch of new forms of animal life.
And in the layers underneath, there would be no intermediate, there'd be nothing leading
with
that.
Any discernible connection. Right.
All right.
And so the Cambrian explosion itself has been differently dated, but increasingly the date that David used of 70 million years is a very generous date for it. The age range is actually narrowing as a result of additional findings. It's now about 10 million years is the increasingly accepted date, and there are major explosions. In one Chinese scene, there's 13 to 16 different major groups of animals that have arisen in a 5 to 6 million year window. It's incredibly abrupt geologically when you consider the age of the Earth is 4.5 billion years. It's also very abrupt biologically because there is a mathematical branch of Darwinian theory called population genetics that allows us to calculate how much change, evolutionary change, we ought to expect in a given amount of time if we know things like the mutation rate, the generation time, the population sizes. And 5, 10, even 70 million years is a blink of an eye in terms of the calculations that can be made for what are called waiting times. And the expected waiting times for the amount of change that's evident in the Cambrian blow out the time scale, if you will. They're hundreds of millions or billions of years. So this is a really unexpected event, both biologically, mathematically, and geologically on a Darwinian view of things.
All right, back to David Galeranter. We move from the fossil record. I'm coming to you. Go nowhere.
I'm patient.
Oh, thank you, David Galeranter. Darwin's main problem is molecular biology. Now, this is complicated to me, but I'm going to continue quoting your essay and then ask somebody to unpack it for this layman here, for this layman who can't tell a cat from a dog apart, the species. Treat me as a very slow student. Quoting, I'm quoting you, what does generating new forms of life entail? Many biologists agree that generating a new shape of protein is the essence of it. Argument step number one. Argument step number two, and inventing a new protein means inventing a new gene. You want to give me the overview on that one?
Steve is the real biologist.
All right. And life means new life, new form of life, means new protein, means new gene.
Well, I'll explain it in terms that would be familiar to David. If you want to give a computer a new function, write a new program for it to accomplish a new function, you've got to give it new code. And the big discovery of 20th century biology, following Watson and Crick in what's now called the molecular biological revolution, is the same thing is true in life. You want to invent a new form of life, you've got to have code in the form of the information inscribed along the spine of the DNA molecule, and we're learning, and other forms of information. So you need the information to build the protein molecules that service the different types of cells, and then you need additional information to arrange the cells into the body plants. And so the Cambrian explosion is an explosion of biological form, but it's also an explosion of biological information. And that fact gives us a way of grappling with this question that Darwin didn't have, because we know something about what it takes to generate information in our high-tech digital world of computing.
Right. I know. I have to say that David Gelernter, in his essay, goes very easy on Darwin. First, he calls the theory beautiful and says how sad he is to have to dismiss it. And then he says this molecular stuff, Darwin couldn't have known that.
He couldn't have known.
So tell me if I've got it more or less right. In Darwin's time, it was good enough to imagine that the basic unit of life, a cell, was like a little brick of jello. It was an undifferentiated, quite uncomplicated thing, and you could imagine putting many, many, many of them together and getting different forms of life. Is that roughly fair?
Yeah, it was good enough for Darwin. It's probably good enough for us as well, but it's not true.
It's not.
That's the big problem. The cell is an unbelievably complex bit of machinery, unfathomably complex. And we haven't understood its complexity at all. Every time we look, there seems to be an additional layer of rebarbative complexity that needs to be factored into our theories. Don't forget, the eternal goal is to explain the emergence of this complexity.
Yes.
And if we're continually behind the curve because the complexity is increasing every time we look, that eternal goal is also receding from view, not approaching, it's receding. It's becoming more and more difficult to construct a theory for that.
All right, now, somebody give me some notion of the math here. Things are more complicated than Darwin knew. We understand that producing new forms of life now means not just new shapes, new activities in which life engages, but a prior code, or is that fair? You're the man who knows code.
You know, the mathematical element of this, not of population genetics in the complex, sophisticated, predictive sense that Steve was referring to, but just the simple issue of the code. It is remarkable for young people to learn in high school, is remarkable for me, or in elementary school, to learn that proteins, molecules are assembled because there are codes in the nucleus of cells that spell them out, character by character, codon by codon. This codon means this amino acid, and the next one means that, and the next one means that. But the mathematics underlying these codons is very simple, and Darwin could perfectly well have understood if he had the facts. Each one of these positions has to be occupied by one of 20 amino acids. Okay, so you pick one of 20 guys for this position and one of 20 guys for this position.
You talk about visualizing a string of beads.
Yeah, like a string of beads.
As you're building a protein.
Yeah. Right. So you have four different colored beads, roughly?
I'm building a protein out of amino acids.
Yes.
And I'm doing it by choosing the amino acids one by one by one by one by one.
Yes.
And I have 20 choices each time. Now, if there are several hundred of these things in the string, in the bead, in the necklace, it's a big necklace that wraps around your neck 18 times. So there are several hundred, or five times, whatever it is. That's a huge number of possible choices. The number of ways in which you can arrange the emerald followed by the ruby, followed by the opal, followed by the chunk of platinum, and another ruby, and another ruby, and a diamond, and a aquamarine, the number of ways you can arrange that is huge, grows exponentially as the string gets longer. So even when the string is short, even if it's a cheap necklace for your very first girlfriend, and it's all you can afford, it's still, there's an astronomical number of choices. And Darwin could easily have computed that. He just didn't know about the amino acids. He didn't know about the necklace. He didn't know about the string. It's not the mathematics that stumped him. It's the biology. The mathematics is simple. A high school student can compute how many choices there are if there are 20 gems for position number one and 20 gems for position number two, and you have 60 gems altogether.
And the task here, let me...
It's 20 to the 60.
Try to mute you, so I'm quoting from your...
Even you can...
Even I got it.
You got it right?
Even mathematicians can understand it.
David, yes. Belinsky has a memorable phrase to describe this mathematical problem. He calls it the problem of combinatorial inflation.
Yes.
As the length, the required length of the protein molecule grows, the numbers grow exponentially. They inflate exponentially. And so the odds of a random search finding the one that makes the pretty necklace, to use David's metaphor, drop precipitously.
And in this huge, unimaginably vast universe of possible combinations, the number of combinations that would produce a useful protein is what?
Exceedingly rare. And this is what we didn't know until the last couple decades. There was an extraordinary conference in the 1960s convened by a number of MIT scientists, some of whom David knew very well, Murray Eden, Marco Schützenberger, and they were the first to see the mathematical problem with Darwinism. They called it, their conference was called Mathematical Challenges to Neo-Darwinism. But at the time, they could compute the number of possible arrangements, but they didn't know at the time how many of the arrangements would result in functional proteins that would do a job in the cell. And so they didn't know, they couldn't exactly measure how hard the search would be on a random basis. Especially the computer scientists, Murray Eden and others, knew that based on computer science, if this is functioning like a true linguistic system, it's unlikely that you can do a random search and find a meaningful string of characters in DNA that will produce a meaningful protein.
Okay.
But people didn't know in the 1960s. By the early 2000s, there have been a number of different experimental measures of the rarity of the functional genes and proteins versus all the gibberish sequences.
Right.
And for example, just one result, for a short protein, 150 amino acids long, the ratio is one protein that will fold into a functional structure compared to 10 to the 77th gibberish sequences. So the ratio of functional to non-functional is 1 over 10 to the 77th power.
Okay, so functioning proteins are extremely rare. It's very hard to imagine random mutations leading to functional proteins, except that, and here I quote Dr. Gelernter again, but the theory understands that mutations are rare, and successful ones even scarcer. Darwinism knows this. To balance that out, there are many organisms and a staggering immensity of time. Your chances of winning might be infinitesimal, but if you play the game often enough, you win in the end. Correct?
That's the theory.
And that's the question. Do you play it often enough? There's always an often enough, and the question is, does the history of life with which Darwin was concerned allow you enough chances to make it at all probable, let's say, or even possible that you'll hit on one, statistically, that you'll hit on one of those amazingly rare necklaces that folds up into a protein that can be stuck in a cell and actually doing anything. I'm not a biologist, and so I look at this and say, yeah, there's enough time. You know, there's been a lot of creatures on Earth, and life has gone on for a long time. But when biologists look at this and try and nail it down and figure it out, try and make a guess, try and use heuristics to make a guess, like using the number of total bacteria lifetime as a measure of the number of total mutations we're playing with. The point is, from whatever angle you come at it, the answer is no, there has not been enough time. The number of throws we've had is too puny even to talk about. It doesn't even approach puniness, and certainly is nowhere near reasonable. So we would get that if we had a reasonable time, but we don't. We didn't. We haven't.
So let me just be very explicit for my little Winnie the Pooh bear-sized mind. You are saying that Darwin is unlikely to have to be able, it's unlikely that species arose the way Darwin said, or you are saying it is impossible. Darwin was just mystic. Lovely man, beautiful idea.
There's hardly a difference. There's hardly a difference. Unlikely, impossible. We're talking about odds that are so prohibitive. If you wish to say it's impossible, fine. I'll defend you saying it's impossible. If you wish to say it's highly unlikely, I'll be in your corner as defense attorney as well. But there's no practical difference. It's look, we've known
it
about these things for hundreds of years.
Right?
You get a million monkeys at a million typewriters, all of them typing at random. We know they're not going to produce the collected works of Shakespeare in anything like a reasonable amount of time. It's like that wonderful episode of The Simpsons. Do you remember it? Mr. Burns has a million monkeys typing in a million typewriters. They're going to produce the greatest novel ever written. He pulls out one sheet of paper and says, it was the best of times, it was the blurst of times.
It was the best of times, it was the blurst of times, you stupid monkey.
Stupid monkey.
Or to put the discussion down even lower, the Jim Carrey film, where he's trying to get a date with a young lady he fancies, and she tells him to go away. He says, well, what are the odds a girl like me and a guy like you could get together? You know, not good. And he says, what do you mean, not good? Well, like 1 in 100? And she says, like 1 in 1,000,000. And then he says, well, but if there's a chance.
So you're telling me there's a chance. Yeah! I read you.
Here's a precise way of cashing out this probabilistic argument. If you have 1 over 10 to the 77th power as your ratio, but then you have all, if every organism in the history of the planet, and we can estimate that, about 10 to the 40th organisms. So you divide
bacteria, little tiny things, everything, every bacterium.
Yeah, every time one of those replicates, there's a possibility for a mutation that could search the space of possibilities. So you got 10 to the 40th possible mutations against a search space 10 to the 77th strong.
Right.
So if you do your exponential math, you end up with, what it means is you can search 1 10 trillion trillionth of the possible combinations. So in that case, are you more likely to succeed or fail? You're overwhelmingly more likely to fail to find one of the functional combinations, even taking into account every organism that's lived on Earth. And that means that the Darwinian hypothesis is overwhelmingly more likely to be false than true.
It just didn't happen.
That was host Peter Robinson of the Hoover Institution speaking with Yale computer scientist David Galanter and Discovery Institute senior fellows Stephen Meyer and David Berlinski. Stay tuned to ID the Future for parts 2 and 3. And for more of Peter Robinson's excellent interview work, just do an online search for Hoover Institution and Uncommon Knowledge. For ID the Future, this has been Tom Gilson. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.